just got dumb. Maybe I should start.
You have an incredibly low bar.
Let me start with an. I've been working on an imagined voice for this guy, Andy Green, the writer.
Oh, sick.
So good. Let me try it. Let me just test it out here.
Thank you for having me on the Oscar Bait podcast here. I talk about my cool list here, 50 most terrible movies by great directors. Like I said, my name is Andy Green. I'm a guy who likes YouTube, Bruce Springsteen, Baba O'Reilly when The Who would do it. I love that. Rock music. And I love The Office. When Jim makes those awkward eyes to the camera, boy, it's like he's breaking the fourth wall right into my living room. Me and my girl make the eyes right back at him. If you haven't been able to tell there, that's the author of the Rolling Stone article we're going to talk about today. That was Andy Green popping by for a second.
Our new favorite film writer.
Author of the comprehensive guide to the television show The Office.
Super sick.
Which is out now.
Oh, it's out already?
Damn. Oh, it's out. Oh, it'll be out. You can find out what kind of plot lines for Dwight got scrapped.
Yeah, I'm dying to know.
Yeah, yeah. Did Stanley get a little pissed when someone said the wrong thing in his presence? Well, he counts how many times Stanley scoffs at the camera.
Wait, is this real? Are you making this up right now? Or is that?
I don't know. I'm just guessing. That's what.
I don't know anymore. It's not hard to be published. So
no, not when you're Rolling Stone's go-to guy to be like Peter Frampton plays song he hasn't played in 6 years to live show last night.
I didn't know Peter Frampton was alive.
I mean, his articles seem to be pretty much about people that you'd think, oh, they're still going. Yeah. Like, here's one. Kool and the Gang sang Celebration when they learned they entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Wow. Cool.
He looks kind of like this Zionist professor at Columbia who's getting mad at that he, what's his name, Shy?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you edge. Oh.
No, I'm just, I had to sneeze and I just thought he was a shy guy and it sounded like that. It wasn't.
He's a shy guy.
Yeah. So yeah, we're coming in hot.
We're back. Yeah. We're back and we're doing an old school episode where we just bitch about stuff and punch down a lot.
Yeah. I mean, this has been sitting on our phone. We've talked. I mean, I don't know. This is so stupid to do it about something that's like weeks old, but I'm still like catching up on the sleep from that fucking excursion into the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. I think I would have been fine if we didn't need to follow it up with a trip to North Carolina, but here we are. It was pretty at least.
Yeah. Well, they got that vinegar cool. Barbecue up there. Is it vinegar?
Or mustard? Oh, hell yeah, they do. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. We just kind of missed it. Not each other. We see each other, talk to each other way too much now.
That's true. All so the time.
There's so much show happening that you all don't even get to be privy to.
That's true. we're just going to, that'll be the new Patreon benefit while we continue to be bad at that. We're just going to connect both our phones to it. And if you sign up for Patreon, you can just read all of our texts back and forth. Mm-hmm. And then make fun of us and guess who's in a worse mood that day based upon tone.
I bet it's going to be me most of the time.
Oh, it's funny. When I was looking back through for something, I forget the other day, something we talked about, I was looking back through our texts and I was like, God, we're such cunts when we're in a mood.
Yeah, when we're on one, yeah, mm-hmm. No, it'd be a lot of me bitching and getting mad at people.
That's true. I guess we'd have to do like the redacted texts so we continue to keep working with everyone that we love.
No, we just put all our thoughts, we keep it secret on a public podcast. So
yeah, we've definitely never shared too much on this at all.
Yeah, we've definitely never burned a bridge potentially because of something that was said. So anyway, we're just gonna continue sparking those matches, baby.
That's right.
As we take down this article, which I just wanna we are well aware this is clickbait. We understand damn well why this exists. There's no real, like, you know, it wasn't like the Wizard of Oz of cinema at Rolling Stone being like, we're going to make the greatest list ever. Like, you know, it's Rolling Stone. Like I said, they're doing articles about, like, Peter Gabriel used an old harmonica when he first was in Genesis last night. It was a show. Like, because no one reads Rolling Stone anymore.
No.
So it's like they got to get on this. They were sitting around their boardroom eating their sweet green, and they said, listen, we need to come up with something that the kids are going to rally and get pissed off over. So what
lucky
better?
For y'all, no one else even saw this except me and you. So you guys failed.
Well, Twitter certainly. Into their tornado, you know, their daily tornado, and then quickly forgot about it. But it's just funny, just like where we're at with what we're supposed to, the dimmest of us think are serious, you know, articles or the sort of investigations of great directors. Because I don't even know what he means by great directors on this
I think he just means people who made more than five movies, one of which was considered great in the history of film. Because that, it's a really low bar, but that's the only way I can explain some of the filmmakers on here. But I don't think anyone has ever said, wow, fucking incredible filmmaker about most of these.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a, like, I went through the AFI 100 best films list and Nate wrote down some directors' names. I also kind of maybe think that he's like equating greatness with like box office hits.
For sure.
You know, there's obviously some filmmakers that could have been on here that were not on here, but I don't know. So let's just have a little fun, because, you know, we're blowing off steam between all of our many things coming up in the world of film programming that we're very excited about.
We'll get to in the middle of the episode, because that's what we do now, because we're learning.
Yeah, so we'll advertise that later and force you to listen to what we have coming up. Okay, let's take a trip down the halls of Rolling Stone and go with Mr. Andy Green and his cool, you know, glasses, his cool frames. And we're going in this room, and he says, here are my 50 most terrible films by the best, the greatest directors. So he starts us off real hot here at number 50 with Penny Marshall's Renaissance Man.
Which, by the way, Penny Marshall had already made a movie called Awakenings prior to this. And don't get me wrong, most of her other movies I do love, because they're good. Riding Cars with Boys in particular is a favorite. But I don't know how you blow past Awakenings to get mad about Renaissance Man.
Yeah. Again, this is something that's going to be said a lot, probably almost as much as when this guy writes that the reason movies aren't good is the actors seem off. Story's bland. Nothing's really ever I know it's little bite-sized blurbs, but it's like, there's no attempt to reckon with the possible faults of any of these movies, except like it's bland. I'm guessing that he just looked at IMDb and whittled down, like, maybe here's a film I've never heard of. Let's look at its box office.
Yeah.
Because it's like the first two are kind of great examples of like, I'm not sure where you're going with this, because 49 is going to be Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain. And I am never going to be one to defend Darren Aronofsky. I think people have gotten way too high on his shit for way too long.
Agreed.
But
like some movies, it's okay. It's fine.
Yeah. But you know, it's like here is clearly a movie where say what you want about the filmmaker, like it was taken away from him. I mean, like they cut the budget by like $45 million. So it's like, you know what?
And like threw away, literally auctioned off all the fucking sets they built the first time he was gonna make it. When it was Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett in it. And then Brad left. He was like, the script sucks, fix it. And they said no.
So. Right. So it's like, so in his like intro to all this, he says, hey, some of these, you know, sometimes films just like fall apart and that's why they're terrible. And it's like, okay, so is that your through line? Movies that fell apart because of budgets? No, because we immediately go on to number 48, James L. Brooks's How Do You Know? Now, if we were following by his very tight rules here, this kind of like structure he's set, well, I guess, how do you know? I can't say it's that bad of a movie, but I can't say it's really good. But it's also like, if you're basing it off of, if The Fountain was the example that was ahead of this, where's what I'm... Much, but I'll do anything in there. There's a movie that literally got like half of its entire point and structure taken away from it. So,
and you could do, I mean, we'll get to him later, but when he gets to his Martin Scorsese choice, it's absurd. He doesn't choose a different obvious movie that would fit what you're saying, except there's no through line here. So,
this is the thing that we can say about all of these, too. Like, there's really no through line. Yeah, you know, so like again, none of us are here to reclaim any of the, well, maybe a couple as
well. There'll be a couple
out and out masterpieces, but no. You know, all right. So number 47, Jonathan Demme's The Truth About Charlie. Now, I didn't get a chance to rewatch The Truth About Charlie.
I did this morning. And I'll say briefly, as we both talked about recently when we rewatched Charade. Charade fell a lot flatter for us than it had in the past.
Yeah, Charade, I do not fuck with.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff I like, but as a whole, the movie didn't work that well for me anymore. So I was excited to rewatch this one, and I did this morning, and it definitely doesn't all come together. But I had a really good time, and it's fun because it's like Demi doing the joining forces with people shooting their movies digitally. In this early 2000s time. And he goes really, you know, probably overboard with it. But I would say if you're like Jonathan Demme head, then you'll enjoy this. And also if for some reason you want to see a digitally shot movie that is has Agnes Varda and Anna Karina singing a Serge Gainsbourg song in it, and then also fucking Charles Aznavour, the dude from Shoot the Piano Player.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's like it was definitely like when it was like cool to be like, I'm doing 60s French New Wave homages.
Yeah, but shot like a
smash cut to right now with fucking what's his face? Richard with Richard Linklater doing that fucking
oh yeah.
Yeah, the French New Wave movie, which... What year did The Truth About Charlie come out? Was that like 2002? Yeah, 2002.
Let's see. Yeah, because it's right after Beloved, right before Storefront Hitchcock. So it's in that interesting spot where he clearly, you know, he'd made studio movies and they went really well. And he was clearly itching to have some fun again. And I think it's fun.
I guess.
It's not bad. Thandie Newton, you know, she's great.
I like how
Reggie Marks, that's okay.
I like how the article's like, this is just a regular failure, but Beloved was a noble failure. What does that mean?
That
one,
means
one had Oprah in it.
Yeah, I think that's a painful virtue signal, is what that is.
Yeah, I think that.
He's like, it's a Toni Morrison, so it cannot be shit talked.
Yeah. Well, now I'd like to do some painful. Shit here. This is where I say enough for these fucking mayo ass male writers. 46, Amy Heckerling. Look who's talking to. Just a weird, just like, okay, that's
yeah.
The Talking Baby movie, the sequel, shockingly, is not as good, not that good.
Yeah, written by Neil Israel of Police Academy and Real Genius fame, back again with Amy to really take this one home. They added Roseanne and Mel Brooks as voices. You know, it's a bad movie, that's for sure. But
I mean, for sure. Is it any worse than Johnny Dangerously?
Absolutely not. Maybe it's better. I don't know if I could pick.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I don't quite like, damn, you got her ass. You got her with the sequel. Here's one that you flipped out about at that bar. 45's Christopher Columbus's Bicentennial Man.
Yeah. This one I actually shockingly definitely a failure. But I really dug it going back to this one. That one, I'm being very genuine on that one.
Uh-huh.
Yep. It's a movie for no one because there's a lot of really borderline, like tasteless, even for me, sexuality for a supposed children's movie.
Well, yeah. Well, wasn't this around the time of Patch Adams as well?
It's in that like real, like just hellscape maudlin Robin Williams time.
Yeah, What Dreams May Come was also in there.
Yeah, just like brutally, brutally over the top sentimentality. But it's mixed with like, yeah, basically this whole movie, if you had to log line it, it's just a robot man wants to fuck this woman, but he can't. So he sticks around for 200 years so he can fuck her granddaughter instead.
Hey, been there.
It's so weird. I don't. Oh, yeah. And again, it's not good at all. But this is a good hangover, fascinating watch, I would say, if folks want to go down that road. But also, I got to bring up here. I don't know about you, but I sure as shit would not call Chris Columbus a great filmmaker at any point in his career. Even though you know, I love the grief porn of Stepmom. The first Harry Potter is great. But Jesus Christ, like Chris Columbus is a great filmmaker. All right.
What? You don't like Percy Jackson and the Book Thief or whatever it's called?
Yeah, no, I watch Home Alone for its filmmaking chops. That's what I do when I watch that movie.
Now, yeah,
it's also like it annoys me that he doesn't go into anything with these blurbs because it'd be interesting to say, how does Nicholas Kazan write Patty Hearst and Matilda and then write some shit like this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that is not on his mind at all. But he does go on to say that, you know, he did Harry Potter next and it's like pretty cool. So number 44. Now here's a director who's, I would say, is great. You've hit on one, and I, you know, let's get into this one. 44, John McTiernan's Basic.
And our fans of this show know how much we fuck with John McTiernan.
Talked about him a lot. I am kind of shocked that he didn't put Rollerball in here. This seems like the kind of movie that he would love to be like, you know, it's actually shit.
Yep. Maybe he just Rebecca Romijn just titillates him too much and he can't say a bad word about any movie she's in.
Yeah. And it's also it's maybe, I mean, that's fair, but it's also like you chose the movie that, like, you know, he was only fated to make probably pretty poorly after the wiretapping scandal and like I mean, it's like that's pretty low hanging fruit. I mean, if you want to be a ballsy ass dude, Mr. Andy Green, pick Medicine Man. It's the middle of his career. You'd actually maybe have me kind of agree with you.
Yeah, Medicine Man is one of the only ones it's hard for me to get much from.
Well, it's like you're thinking his run is Nomads, Predator, Die Hard, Hunt for Red October, then Medicine Man. Then Last Action Hero, Die Hard with a Vengeance. You know, it's like, come on, man. Also, if you want to be a real ballsy ass writer and get some real clicks, put Predator in there.
Yeah, it's true. If you're really trying to get clicks, just do some shit talking. Pretend you're at a bar drunk, trying to upset your bud.
It's true. I would respect Predator as a choice. Much
Yeah, it'd be more interesting because this shit is just too easy. Like, yeah, basic's not good, but also I don't know if you agree, but Giovanni Ribisi's performance in this is enough to keep me going every time. He's great.
Yeah, I mean that twist is stupid. I will admit
Oh, very stupid.
it's silly. You don't under you almost kind of under don't understand why it was made, but like, you know, it's good to look at. It's good. It's fine. Now, not so good to look at coming in the middle of a very hot career that I don't know if I would consider this guy a great filmmaker. Richard Donner's Assassins. Now, we just had some fun at the old Hollywood Theater with our buddy Mr. Dan Halstead taking us into his cool little print vault, and we got to come face to face with the reels of Assassins.
Yeah, which I'll say the same thing we said to Dan because he hadn't watched it yet. This movie's a mess for sure, but what you come for is Antonio Banderas because he is still very much in that Pedro Almodovar mode. So he is just full of sex and fire, and he's awesome in this movie. And Julianne Moore plays a fucking hacker, and it's the hottest shit ever. She has a cat. It's really fun, that part. And then you have Sylvester Stallone doing a really bad job in this movie. And so oh goddamn, do you feel its runtime? But this is another one that if this guy's goal was to talk about troubled productions, it could be interesting because this is the first movie the Wachowskis wrote.
Yeah, it was completely
And
rewritten.
then they tried to get their name taken off of it. What's the dude, Brian Hegeland, who
Yeah.
rewrote? Because I guess Donner and Sylvester Stallone were like, it's too violent, and Stallone's character is not sympathetic enough.
Absolutely. Also, a horrible opening. The opening of that movie stops every bit of momentum going, and yeah, it really, this is one of those things on this list that is kind of like, yeah, what happened here? Like, the dude was a box office, you know, dynamo. I mean, you know, going from the Superman, the Omen, Goonies, Lethal Weapon, Scrooge, the Lethal Weapon 2, 3, Maverick, and then Assassins.
Yep. Maverick Assassins, then Conspiracy Theory.
And then Conspiracy Theory and Lethal Weapon 4. And that movie Timeline with Paul Walker, which I don't even know what that is.
Well, as you said at the top, even though I love the majority of the movies this guy made, for me at least, I think I'd struggle to try to talk about him as an auteur. I think he's a good studio filmmaker. So calling him amazing, I think, is weird.
Yeah, if you want to talk about amazing, little film he did called The Toy.
Oh, well, I love that
Where
one too, man.
Jackie
Painfully
Gleason, where
mishaps.
Jackie Gleason as a black man pretend to be a toy for his son, who's played by the kid that sticks his tongue on the pole in Christmas Story.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, Assassins, fascinatingly bad movie.
That's
Now,
another, I'd say, hangover movie if you do want to watch it,
if you
just
want to
rough
make your hangover worse, yes. Yeah.
it up. Yep.
42 here, Spike Lee's Girl 6. Well, it's not hard to pick through Spike Lee's filmography and come up with a dud. This might be the least dud of the duds in that 20 minutes of this movie, the first 20 minutes worked pretty well. But yeah, clearly Mr. Spike has not found his way when it comes to sex work and women's, you know, owning their sexuality, which starts very promising. I mean, you got
It's so strong.
Naomi
Teresa Randall's
Campbell.
great.
Yeah,
Yep.
Naomi Campbell doing that great little fucking drippy dick, monologue. You know, good stuff there, but yeah, Girl 6 completely collapses on itself and does a lot of finger wagging
Oh
very
my God.
the
And it's
very end of
so
the movie.
serious. It's so serious about itself, and it's really fucking painful. And it sucks too, because if you haven't seen this movie, you've definitely heard the music because Prince did it and it's fucking cool. So there should have been, it should be the best movie. It's a setup for great success everywhere except for Spike.
Yeah, every ounce of fun that was going on just sucked out of this movie. And, you know, I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. Rereading a lot of contemporary reviews of this movie on Letterboxd has me really worried for you all. Has me deeply worried for some people and what they find to be subversive, like hyper-real cinema. Oof. Yeah, Girl 6 ain't it. But, again, it's I don't know if it's really qualifies as terrible, unless terrible is, oh, you had something great going for it and then you decided to double down on your kind of outdated moralistic attitudes about sex, because I don't know, someone tells me Spike was not fucking a lot until he became a hit filmmaker.
Oh well, I mean, yeah there's that, you know. Yeah, Spike's a dude's dude, I would say, from what I can tell, always has been.
And he likes movie. Dudes.
No. Oh. I said he's a dude's dude.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Comes to this kind of stuff. Okay,
yeah. That's like bold claim.
No, I would. That this movie would be more interesting if he was gay. Not in saying it would succeed either, but no, I think he's just too much. It's like when everyone talked about the nudity and Do the Right Thing, and she's like, "I'm friends with him now. It's cool, but that sucked." You know, like, I think Spike's just, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Spike.
Oh, Spike. But he did make Get on the Bus right after, so that helped. That movie's good.
Yeah, get on and get on the back. So,
We're doing good.
We're doing good. 41.
Next up, another hot take. Wow.
Yeah, I don't know about this. Steven Soderbergh's The Good German seems like pretty easy sniping to be like, oh, what's the one Steven Soderbergh movie that I have not heard of that has George Clooney, Cate Blanchett, and Tobey Maguire in it? I do like how he says that the movie is, I mean, I know I'm being a little ticky-tack here, but he does like this. He's like, he pulls out every effort to make this look like an actual film noir from the 40s. Well, film noir was a post-war. But fair enough, it is black and white. He's correct about that. Yeah, and a poster that paid homage to Casablanca. But
it didn't pay homage, it just is the poster, buddy. Take a breath.
There he goes again. He spent so much time in the look, the story suffered. Well, Andy Green, if you could, listen, you're the expert on The Office, so tell us how, you know, the plot breakdowns of something like The Good German suffer in comparison to three episodes of The Office, because I'm all aboard listening to what your point is here, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you could pull probably some other Soderbergh films out and throw them in there.
Well, yeah, because he loved to, again, it's a missed opportunity to talk about something interesting, whether you like it or not, is this Soderbergh loves nothing more than just fucking swinging for the fences with whatever he's obsessed with. He loves to experiment. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. All right. Like, you know, I mean, he made Bubble right before this.
Oh, Bubble.
I'm glad at least he didn't put that on, because Bubble rules. But, you know, whatever. Good German's fine.
So what do you have to say about number 40, Sidney Pollack's Random Heart?
Oh, my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, you claimed that.
Oh, no, God, no. This movie sucked.
Okay. All right. No.
This movie sucked very much, and it, I would say, just continued what Sidney Pollack was doing right before it, where he remade Sabrina, which is a great idea, also sucks. And then, yeah, he made this. I don't know. Harrison Ford's fine in it, I guess.
It's a kind of it. Stupid movie. It's a pretty stupid movie about
it painfully needs a rewrite.
Yeah, it's about a cop and a congresswoman who find out that their respective partners were having affairs with each other, but they they, but what I thought the movie was about is them getting the ultimate revenge by their partners that cuckolded them dying in a plane crash, which sounds awesome. A great movie.
That would be cool.
But unfortunately, it goes on and goes on, and you have to give a shit about a cop and a congresswoman.
Yeah, and it's really hard because there's also not a lot of pacing at play.
Well, it's just such a night, like an early 2000s, late 90s kind of like, you know, you know what people want to know about? Cops and congresswomen and
lives. They're just like us.
They're just like us. I would never claim Sidney Pollack's a great director, but a perfect movie for this, along with this, would have also been, have you ever seen Havana?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Who boy? Yes.
I mean, Havana or Sabrina of his, honestly, I think fit better than this.
Yeah. Well, alas, Sidney Pollack, your worst film is Random Hearts.
Official. It's weird to include him because even though he made definitely one of my favorite World War I movies ever, Castle Keep, he's another that I would not say has a strong stamp that I would ever know he directed the movie past the beginning of his career.
I mean, there's like, what? You've got Jeremiah Johnson.
Yeah, we got 3 Days of the Condor.
Yakuza.
There's good movies in there, but he is not I don't think he's a great filmmaker at all.
No. Now, what about number 39, The Wachowskis with Jupiter Ascending?
Well, I texted you about this one. I was bummed because I remembered this a lot kinder than the reality I was faced with. As soon as I hit play and the voiceover started.
Oh, yeah.
This is a fucking doozy. And for me, at least, I don't know how you felt rewatching it, but this was a really unpleasant and difficult experience.
Yeah, it's actually much worse than I remember. I still think Cloud Atlas somehow annoys me more, but...
Yeah, I mean, I still like Cloud Atlas, but I absolutely understand what you mean with that.
What we're getting closer to is the kind of absolutely brain dead, stupid sort of like mentality that was going to inform, I guess, Lana's The Matrix Resurrections? Is that what it's called? The latest one? Matrix 4. Just a lot of dumb like attempts at humor that, you know, just fall so flat. And honestly, for something like Speed Racer, having this like childlike, you know, eye of cinema makes a lot more sense. But, you know, they tried to get too important, I guess. I don't know, because what's funny about Jupiter Ascending is, yes, you reminded me of a very unfortunate article by someone who, as I told you, we should have seen the signs early. But I remember reading it, and the thing that has always stuck out of me is that it's compared to Thomas Pynchon. And
oh, that's so brutal. That line is brutal. I was like, brutal. What the fuck, man? What that's kind of brutal. That is good ass cocaine you're doing.
I wish that was what was going on.
Oh, I know. Well, that's what, you know, when I'm trying to be nice and I don't say the thing that I relate to, because it's just good ass mental illness is the thing that you're doing.
I think that's called a windowless garden apartment.
Oh, zooted on the blackout curtains is how you get to Thomas when you watch Jupiter Ascending.
100%. But again, like, against all these other movies, like, a valiant failure, you know, at least they went out.
Oh, they go so hard. And that's why. That's why the Wachowskis were exciting every time it was a new movie, because you knew they were going to fucking go for it.
Yeah, I would almost take the fourth Matrix being much worse, because at least this movie was trying to be this goofy little space opera, whereas that was like, we're coming back and we're going to get meta about the Matrix.
We're going to get meta about meta. It's that
literally.
It's brutal.
Like, we just got out of the pandemic, and it's like, this is what we have to watch, The Matrix Resurrections.
Yeah, it was not a great return to Jupiter Ascending. But again, I wouldn't even call it a terrible movie, despite how upset I was while watching it this time.
Oh, yeah. Does not hold up. Now, number 38. The one I've maybe said too much about in my time, but I also do not think that this is a terrible movie, but I think I've spoken on this before on the show. So let's see what Will thought about Alexander Payne's Downsizing.
Yeah, I also saved that one for this morning. So after Truth About Charlie, popped this puppy on. I definitely don't think it's a terrible movie. So I agree with you there. I did when it came out. I was furious. I was one of those, one of the many, because that's what most people thought. I no longer think it's a terrible movie at all. What I now think basically is I am just so sad that this was not made when it was originally supposed to be, because this was going to be fall in the earlier side of Payne's career, but things didn't work out. And then he, in my opinion, switched to the mode that is hard for me, that starts with, you know, there's a little in Sideways, but really starts with Descendants and Nebraska. And I think if this movie would have been made before Payne was as sentimental, or I guess just softer hearted as he is now, I think it could have been really fucking awesome. Right. Cause I was just imagining a world where like the guy who made Citizen Ruth made Downsizing in that era. Yeah. Like how interesting it could have been. Cause he can't decide for me. He just can't decide if this is a maudlin kind of thing, or if this is a satire, or if it's, you know, another thing. It's just too many ideas for him. He's good at really small stuff, I think. And I think it's just a little too big of a world for him to figure out what he wants to do with it.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that is definitely trying to, again, like, but different than the Wachowskis, but similar. Like, it's reaching for something that is so much more admirable than a lot of the movies on this list that we wouldn't even say are that bad. But it's this kind of like trying to grapple with our existence as people that I guess I always found so moving about it. Now, we always have rose-tinted glasses sometimes when we look at some of these things. There are things that do not work about this movie. Mainly two actors in it, Christoph Waltz and Udo Kier. Their part I find absolutely obnoxious in the movie.
That's actually one of my favorite parts.
Okay.
Now, it was not before. I agreed with you previous to this rewatch.
I like them. It's just there's too much of them. Like there's almost too much of a reliance on them.
The balance is just way off. There's no balance of the varying people and storylines here.
Which is interesting because like Kristen Wiig kind of disappears early on. And I think when she vanishes from the plot, even though you could have taken more of her because she's doing really well in the movie, gone from the movie. And it's like, oh, you know, like I feel that presence that's missing in his life. It's a very lonely movie. And I think like what you could have done with Udo and Christoph is, you know, maybe trimmed them up a little bit in the movie because they do try to like become like these great comedic side pieces for the movie that like the thing that makes them funny just gets repeated ad nauseum, you know, way too much in the movie.
Yeah. I agree. I think they're in a satire and no one else is.
Maybe, or they're literally trying to do some like Farrelly Brothers sort of like riffing to some degree.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like you definitely think they thought they were much smarter and funnier than they were. And
well, I think both their performances are good. I just don't think it fits together. Because when it is sentimental, it is so painfully sentimental. And so then when you have them, you know, making their dumb fucking jokes, everything just feels off.
Yeah. I think the problem Alexander Payne, and we'll move on because we're spending way too much time on Downsizing, but I think we think Alexander Payne really knew that he had something good with this story, but it's almost like he felt like people would miss it and just assume it's a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids sort of like super special effects excursion. And he feels like he has to constantly remind you where the heart of this movie is, and that's obnoxious.
Calling this a terrible movie, I think, is very silly.
Agreed. Now,
very, very silly.
Now let's talk about a movie that we all love over here. That we're going to defend to the wall. 1984's masterpiece, Garbodox. Like, what's the point of putting Garbodox on this list? You went through Sidney Lumet's filmography and you were like, what is this one? I remember this playing on HBO when I was younger. Oh boy. Oh boy. I mean, again, here is a perfect example of a guy who might have been a filmmaker early on who he loses his way pretty fast and only seems to stumble into good movies kind of like at random.
I agree. He came out the gate fucking incredible. And like when I was first getting into movies, Sidney Lumet was one of the first because I just was watching In Order and I was like, this is the most amazing shit I've ever seen. And then all of a sudden it stops and doesn't really ever return necessarily.
Yeah. What was that one where it's like, like Melanie Griffith, like investing, it's like they were trying to obviously like get off the success of Witness. So it's like Melanie Griffith in a Hasidic Jewish community.
Oh yes.
And the tension.
Yeah, Stranger Among Us.
The tension is she has to eat their disgusting food.
God damn. You gotta make your Hasidic jokes, huh? Good.
Listen, it's okay. You can make Hasidic jokes. They don't believe in COVID, Will, so it's okay to make fun of an entire community.
It's true. All of them signed the letter that said COVID is not real.
I mean, actually, if one community was maybe gonna do that, it was...
Yeah.
Anyway.
This movie's this guy could have talked about something interesting. This is a great example of actually what could have been a pretty interesting idea for a movie and what should have been crack for film lovers with some of the cast and with the idea, but instead it is not. This is just a movie without a heartbeat all the way through.
How about his embarrassing attempt to remake Gloria? Shouldn't that be something that we consider terrible?
Much worse.
Much, much worse. And you can put Sharon Stone in there when she was cooking like nobody's business. And dear God, does that movie suck?
yes, it does.
Speaking of which, Gloria playing Monday, May 16th?
13th.
Oh, so close this time. That's right. Monday, May 13th at the Music Box Theater, we will be showing John Cassavetes' Gloria, along with Clint Eastwood's The Bridges of Madison County in beautiful 35mm.
That's right. We'll be talking about moms that rule and do what they want and filmmakers that rule and can take for hire jobs and still do a better job than anyone that's ever worked for A24.
Yeah. So there's our first plug.
We did it. Yeah, and it's day after Mother's Day, by the way.
It is the day after Mother's Day, which if you really care about your mom, the day after Mother's Day is technically still Mother's Day.
That's right.
Yeah.
We believe Mom's Day is all fucking year because we love our moms.
Yeah, don't be one of these people that hates mothers.
Just, yeah. Don't be a mother. That's fine, but...
Yeah.
You hate moms, come through. They're
if
still
you
great.
Monday is a day you get to quit thinking about your dumb bitch mom, then you are behind in the times and you need to start thinking about that woman who gave birth to you for a whole week. What you did to her body with your fucked up head coming out of that thing.
That's right. Honestly, you need to find the amount of hours mom was in labor, and that's how many days you celebrate Mother's Day every year.
Mm.
I think that's a fair rule.
I agree. Yeah. So come celebrate a Mother's Day with us the day after Mother's Day. All right. Let's move on with this list here. Now, this is a funny one. Number 36, John Carpenter's The Ward. Now, what's interesting about choosing John Carpenter here is like seems to be a bit of a cheat, because it's like, you know, John Carpenter had kind of been out of the game for several years before he made The Ward. How long was it between?
10 years. 10 years between Ghosts and The Ward, and he had his two Masters of Horror TV movies in between, but 10 years since a feature theatrical.
Yeah. I love how in this thing, well, I'm not going to read the what he wrote here, but he does say, you know, many detractors point to Memoirs of the Invisible Man or Ghosts of Mars. All right. This is where I risk sounding a little like Will, but Memoirs of Invisible Man, top tier. That's top tier entertainment. That's a good day of sitting on the couch watching just a breezy movie that's shot like $1 million. Have nothing bad to say about Memoirs of an Invisible Man. And it's got Chevy Chase in it. And that's pretty easy to talk some shit on Chevy Chase at that time. Because boy,
most Chevy Chase movies at that time, years ahead and years after, are really tough. So good job, John.
Good job, John. Just banishing him off screen was a good.
Well, you get his smug fucking face out of there and things work well.
It actually helps a lot.
Well, he was too coked out to like do anything correctly with his face. So John Carpenter was like, all right, I got it. No problem.
Damn, I might watch Memoirs of Invisible Man later today. To point out, there's no Paul Verhoeven on this list.
Yeah, I was surprised when we first saw it. I was waiting, but
that's how you know who this guy's looking up the greatest directors. I bet if I Google greatest directors,
well, yeah,
this absolutely is going to be all of these people. Because we'll get to some other ones too. It's very funny, but it's like, okay. So anyway, he also says Ghosts of Mars, which is also ridiculous. Ghosts of Mars
he's fucking wrong.
There are many problems with Ghosts of Mars, but it is a good movie.
Oh, we'll be showing Ghosts of Mars sooner than later. Oh, yeah. Undoubtedly.
Oh, absolutely. No, I fuck with those movies. And also the Ward is like, yeah, again, it falls into a trap of like a twist that is goofy and stupid. But like, I don't know, act like you've been to the movies, man. Act like you're a real fan. Like, what's cool is like you see that man who is, I mean, everyone wants to remember John Carpenter for like the images he gave us, which is important, but how he gave us those images and his perfect, perfect mise-en-scene, his flawless, constantly imitated to this day formalism. I mean, what he did with the widescreen is nothing short of revelatory. And yeah, like it's imprinted on so many young filmmakers today. So when you see The Ward, it's like, yeah, the movie's not good, but damn, my man has not lost the ability to shoot a movie.
No, and I don't even think it's that bad, really. I really don't. I think it's a perfectly it's serviceable awkward. Night
it's
at the
an
movie.
Awkward movie, yeah. Because you kind of feel like he doesn't know what to do with the performers. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I kind of forgot the history of this one here. I don't know. Yeah, let's real quick. Because like, yeah, like Amber Heard is a little awkward in the movie, but you know, I can't say that like John Carpenter's ever been a filmmaker who I say is like really good at crafting performances. That's not something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He just works with good people and this kind of lets them go.
He knows who to cast.
Right.
And he's most successful. Cause that's why, you know, like with when we did They Live, right? Like that great clip of him talking about Roddy Piper. He's just like, this man has lived and has seen so much and been through so much. So I knew he'd be great. And he did. He didn't tell him how to play it. He just said, you are great. Do that.
Yeah. I mean, but there is something about this movie that shows kind of a difference of like acting from more amateur actors. Cause it's like with Assaults on Precinct 13. Now, obviously he's probably doing as much time. He's spending as much time with the actors on that movie, but there's something about a kind of amateur performance of the late 70s that you just kind of, it just kind of works for the movie. Whereas by the time we get to 2010, I don't know. There's a bit of an overacting. Everyone's trying to give like a little bit more of their performance than they need to. And John is probably so stoned behind the camera. He's like, whatever, you know, I got Mass Effect to play at home.
Yeah, he's like, my shots look perfect. Do what you will. See you at the end.
Yeah, and Carpenter himself says he was burned out. So I found a quote here. He says he's fallen out of love with cinematic storytelling. So that's why he started doing the Masters of Horror. And
which, by the way, if you haven't seen it, Cigarette Burns is fucking awesome. Pro-life is not, but it's worth
it. No, it's not. Cigarette Burns is a lot of fun. And it's interesting to see what he's like when he's reduced to not having his big old frame that he loves so much.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on. Number 35, Frank Oz's The Stepford Wives.
And again, we keep saying it, but this is, you know, again, endless missed opportunities to talk about films that were compromised. Everyone probably knows at this point, but this movie was dark as shit, had a real harsh ending, a lot more similar in tone to the original film. Would have been awesome, probably, honestly. But the test screenings were bad. And Frank Oz, like, well, him talking about his show, Sheepish, I feel so bad for him. Because he's like, I got caught in that shit. I cared too much about what the studio wanted. And I did what they said. So,
yeah. Again, you'll probably have more people reaching to rewatch The Stepford Wives than, say, The Indian in the Cupboard.
Oh, I actually just downloaded that again the other day because I was like, we should go back to there and see what's up.
I don't think I have it in me. I don't think I had it in me when I was a kid watching The Indian in the Cupboard.
I don't remember if I liked it as a kid or if it's just, because it was just like a go-to substitute day at school movie, so it just played a lot in my youth, but I don't remember if I even liked it then.
Well, it made me mad. It's like, you're putting this little indigenous toy in there. Put a fucking Ninja Turtle in that cupboard.
I bet that's what a 5-year-old you said. Mom, why are they doing an indigenous small man instead of a Ninja Turtle?
Yeah, that seems almost vaguely offensive to reduce compare. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know what the hell is up with this movie. I'm never going to rewatch it. But, you know, this kid must be an absolute loser because it's like, put your Batman toy in there, you fucking nerd. What, you want to learn about, like, the murder, the massacre of the buffalo? Like, come on. Come on, put your Swamp Thing figure in there and have a little fun for a change, pal.
I'll report back. But yeah, Stepford Wives, you all know the deal. It's a similar instance of too many tones that don't work together. So there's the movie they wanted to make and the movie they gave in and made instead. So, but again, I wouldn't even call this a terrible movie personally. It's not good, but
would you call, and you certainly wouldn't call it a horrid movie either.
No, I would not call it a horrid movie.
It takes a lot to call a movie a horrid movie. But for Daniel Green or whatever his name is, for number 34, Ang Lee's Gemini Man certainly receives the horrid title. According
Oh, is that to what he says?
That's what he says.
Oh, and a horrid movie. Okay.
A horrid movie. No, it's a pretty fun little action movie. I'm going to be honest. It's a neat little action movie. And seeing 3D,
it's a good time.
3D was the 3D was cool.
Yeah, I got this. The 3D was cool. The aging was bad. The de-aging was bad. Whatever. It's still fun.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. I remember a certain movie called Taking Woodstock.
Oh, now that.
That might qualify.
With actually earning horrid. That is
had nothing to do with Woodstock. Like, there's barely any Mitch. I remember seeing that in like stupid, like, I mean, I don't even know how young I was when that came out. I mean,
I think it's like first year of college.
Probably first year of college, where you still think like Woodstock's a cool ass thing, and you're like, damn, like I just saw Woodstock. What was that other documentary that came out around that time? There was another documentary about a 60s music festival.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. This is why you tune in to listen to two fucking idiots not remember things. Let's see here. God damn. This is really embarrassing.
Festival Express.
Festival Express. Thank you.
Here we go. Yeah.
Festival Express. Yeah, I remember Festival Express coming out and being like, damn, my friends and I were going to get a Volkswagen van and we're going to listen to Canned Heat and we're going to just drive around. Yeah, that's right. Janis Joplin, The Grateful Dead, Flying Burrito Bro.
Our buddy Robbie Robertson there, of course.
Yeah. I think this is post Graham Parsons, Flying Burrito Brothers, but that's okay. yeah, but anyway, there's no need to go down this this rabbit.
The last thing we do have to say, though, just to remind you why maybe that movie does deserve the word horrid. All of what we said, yes, but if you're lucky enough to not remember a time where comedians reigned supreme again, from about 2001 to 2010, and one of the comedians that people really loved for some reason was Dimitri Martin, and so Ang Lee said, "I'm going to put you in a movie not about Woodstock called Taking Woodstock," and it's going to be so fun.
I'm taking away your marker and your whiteboard too. So.
Yeah, what are we going to do without those great jokes?
Yeah.
Doc watching the movie.
Yeah. Boy, he was a terrible, like, precedent to, like, the type of people that now make PowerPoints for fun.
Yep.
Have you noticed? There is a thing. There's a certain person who does a comedy night where people make PowerPoints about, you know, I'm not going to shit talk at someone I like, but let's just say we've gotten into an era where making a PowerPoint is fun.
Cool. Y'all need to remember that school sucks. All right. You need to fucking skip class and drink some beer. Stop thinking school is cool and making a PowerPoint for fun.
That's right. Shoot that place up one day. Just do something cool about that.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Yeah, this is what happens when you take this away from us, or we take it away from ourselves.
Yep. And just to remind you, someday we will get to do a school shooter series.
It will happen. You'll see.
It'll happen. It'll happen.
Anyway, 33, Billy Wilder's Buddy Buddy. What's the point of even putting Buddy Buddy on here? That's just kind of like elder abuse.
Also, I don't know about you. Don't worry. I'm not here to say this is misunderstood, because it is not. It's tough. It is tough. But this movie has, you know, a couple moments of pleasure at least. And I don't think it belongs in a list like this. I think that's pretty silly. It's not that bad in the realm of what we're saying, if we're saying terrible, you know.
But he does,
I wouldn't call this terrible.
But he does play this game where he, like, shorthand to find a bad movie by a quote-unquote great director is, I pick it at the very end of their career.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, which is fucking lame. And also, if you...
Where's Don Siegel on here? Where the fuck is Don Siegel on this list, you fucking pussy?
Nope, he's hidden. He's like, hidden. But if you like Wilder, honestly, like, the way I've gotten so many people to watch this movie and get them to stick it out is, like, look, Billy Wilder got obsessed with Klaus Kinski and said that he had the most interesting face since Conrad Veidt in the history of movies.
Oh, God.
And so he cast Klaus Kinski in this. Worth watching.
True.
That's fucking cool. And everyone was sad. They all knew it wasn't good. They all knew it was a misstep, and it was a sad way to go out. So putting it on here is lame.
Yeah, and also Don Siegel. You could have put Rough Cut Jinxed on there. Jinxed would have counted for two, because that's Sam Peckinpah's and Don Siegel's last.
That's true. You could have got creative with this. Fit more filmmakers.
You're killing me, Daniel David Green or whatever. You're like, so bad.
Daniel Day Green Lewis. You need to honestly go the way of Daniel Day Lewis and just call it and retire. That's what you need to do.
Literally, because for 32, you put Milos Forman's Goya's Ghosts on there. Who gives a shit? Like, also, Milos Forman, a great director for sure, but like, could you have maybe picked something from the middle of his career that's not so good? I'm trying to think of this movie. Now I have to look this one up, unfortunately. Because there's one he made right in the heart of his career that... Oh, yeah, duh. Hair. How about Hair? How about putting Hair on there? That movie sucks dick. Terrible.
terrible.
And see, the fun thing is, I love hair, but I agree with you. Just because I grew up on it.
Probably purely fine. The movie is dog shit, except for Beverly D'Angelo's titties.
Well, that's why it was such a big movie growing up in a sheltered household, because it was rated PG. So yes. I was allowed to watch hair. Yes. And I had seen Christmas Vacation. And so naturally I was obsessed with Beverly D'Angelo. And my friend was like, her boobs are out in this musical. We should watch it. And I was like, okay, you're right.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the first Vacation where you also see her titties?
No. I had only seen Christmas Vacation. Oh, I wasn't allowed to watch.
You see side boob in that one for sure. Yes,
but I wasn't allowed to watch the first one because it was rated R. So
why didn't you do the hack? Why didn't you do the Amy Heckerling European Vacation hack?
There was a video store.
Oh, because I was gonna say you get two pairs of titties in that PG-13 movie.
No. The video store closed when I was like 8, so I didn't have much of a chance to get creative.
My parents really were wondering why I loved European Vacation so much after a while. I was like, it's good, it's very good.
You like masterpiece. Still to this day, John's first book is going to be just about that movie.
My experience of pausing it and showing my friends and being like, look at that.
Look, guys, boom.
Internet porn didn't exist then, really. So, like, not at that time, not when we were in elementary school. So,
no, it was a better time because that was the update to, you know, what 70s kids love to talk about with hiding a magazine in the woods under a log or whatever the fuck.
Oh, well, we did that. Yep.
It was instead hiding a VHS tape in the Little Mermaid case.
Exactly. Or you go to you think of your friend who has the most alcoholic father in fourth grade, and you're like, let's go through his closet and let's look behind some stuff. Man, my friend Travis, he had this dad that had a fucking stack of I forget what it was called. I think it was called Club.
Oh no, yeah, it is.
But it was just the most nasty.
Well, club is like if someone opened up a Hustler
and was very sticky like, pages. Yeah. We were like, why are these pages? We literally were like, why are all the pages stuck together?
Yeah. No, like truly club is like dark, dark shit. Definitely no one gets paid who's in that magazine. Rough shit.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. Anyway, what were we talking about? Goya's Ghosts? Great.
You guys come here because while we're talking about Milos Forman, we accidentally started a fucking Club magazine.